Hello, this is Bob and Cameron again. This is episode number 26, being recorded on June 17th, 2021, starting at 2:45 a.m. Hawaii time, 2:45 in the morning. Okay, Cameron, you have an issue about a term I use you want to look at.
Well, that's right. We're doing the Tech Body interview with anybody, and I'm interested in getting clarified how the anthropomorphic physical, the AP, and the Android meme relate to the Tech Body. My understanding is that they all have to do with the loss of the human in the modern world, but I believe that they're differentiated amongst themselves.
Yes. So we're looking at my tiny note chart, which we've done a lot of details on in the past. You've got four quadrants: LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, William Irwin Thompson, and Croker, Arthur Croker. And then on the bottom is the Dobbs quadrant, the fifth area. And I call my quadrant anthropomorphic physical, as opposed to LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker being holopathic satellite environment. So it's a satellite environment, and then holopathic radio, TV, computer, and then the satellite environment itself. So holopathic is the shrinking, compressing of the Android meme, which we experienced from 1960 to 1990. So anthropomorphic refers to anthropomorphism, where humans project human qualities into the external environment or contents of the external environment. And I thought I had to add the word physical, because the holopathic discarnate refinements, disembodied refinements, moved away from what people thought was physical, at least in the natural, organic sense of their bodies. But they still projected a sense of the physical. So the sense of the physical became up for grabs in all cultures. Different cultures, based on their background, would be forced to change and adapt and preserve their sense of the physical or of the chemical body in different ways around the world. So what was in common is that they thought there was a human extension in the environment, or that the environment was biased toward the humans, or what's the other one? McLuhan's phrase, media, the extensions of man. That is a anthropomorphic projection, that they have something to do with our bodies. McLuhan's idea wasn't seen as an anthropomorphic projection, I don't think, at the time in the 50s and 60s, because he was countering the more cliche attitude or meme that technology was an invader and an alien force. So McLuhan tried to humanize it, in a sense. But when I lumped him in with Thompson, LaRouche, and Croker, he's just another guy dealing with the anthropomorphic physical or projecting it. So because, why did I make my quadrant anthropomorphic physical? Because working with Carolyn for so many years on health and coming up with new gadgets like the AIDS treatment in the 90s in New York City, it was called MIHR. MIHR stood for magnetic homeopathic remedies. MIHR. don't remember what the I stood for. Well, it's in an earlier recording. And then we got even more stuff, pretty amazing savings, energizing mutations of the anthropomorphic physical with some stuff Ion dropped on us. So the chart is the first four quadrants floating around me. I put myself at the center of it for different reasons, and we've gone through that. So the anthropomorphic physical uses the term anthropomorphic to show that we are projecting. I want people to know that I'm aware that our efforts to understand our environment is anthropomorphic or includes that. In case someone says, well, that's naive, blah, 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 and you don't know about the anthropomorphism. So it was almost a, what would you call a defensive move, just to say, okay, I'm aware of the anthropomorphic levels of our reality, and so I put that in the chart. Does that explain something to you?
Yeah, it explains something, but for example, when you say you're aware of anthropomorphic projections, do you then take that as far as Nietzsche, let's say, where Nietzsche basically says that everything is an anthropomorphic projection, because it is, we end up in nihilism, because when we ask ourselves what is an anthropomorphic projection, all we can come up with is another projection. And another projection after that, another projection after that, and there is no ground on which to valorize any one of these. So it's like sand running out of out of the beach back into the ocean. There's nothing left in Nietzsche's conception. Once you start going down that path of projection.
Right. And did you say, you didn't say allegorize, but you said alloy or something. We maybe allow? There's a word there that didn't come through clearly.
Sorry, I don't recall.
Yeah.
Maybe I started to say like sand out of an hourglass, and then I thought to myself, but the sand doesn't leave the hourglass, so I better come up with something else.
Yeah, so I came up with it. It was half a word, the hour. Well, you cut it off.
Yeah.
Okay. I agree about the nihilism, but that was assigned to the Croker quadrant. He writes about Nietzsche. He's a great Nietzsche student. So he talks about technological nihilism. So that projection of what the anthropomorphic operation is covered in the Croker quadrant. McLuhan may be seen as an optimist or some kind of Christian believing their salvation. Thompson would go into the mystic Gnostic version of salvation through Buddhism, and LaRouche thought technology would improve. He wasn't as drastic as Nietzsche. He actually wrote a lot of criticisms of Nietzsche. So I consider the four quadrants as styles of anthropomorphism, and that would include Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So
Yes, sir. I can understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. And now note, I say LaRouche is a representative of paranoia, and he's an extension of Ezra Pound. McLuhan represents schizophrenia, and he's an extension of Wyndham Lewis. Thompson represents hysteria, ecological hysteria, all the eco-movements of starting in Earth Day. And so he's an extension of T.S. Eliot. And Croker, as a panic, representing panic, putting it on, he did the Panic Encyclopedia. He is an extension of W.B. Yeats. Me and my quadrophenia, or more conscious quadriphenia than the rest of them. I say they're all quadriphenic, which the popular term is polymath. So they're all polymaths. And I said they're all quadriphenic, but I'm the quadriphenic that's aware of the whole process for some reason, mm-hmm. because I came later, let's say. I put myself in as ecstasy. And I see that as an extension of Joyce. Joyce was not a Menippean, Don Thiel said. He was a Veronian satirist, which included natural joy and even being silly. And Lewis, more cynical, sort of, was a Menippean satirist. And Thiel, from his personality level, thought McLuhan was more cynical than himself. So Thiel thought he was the Veronian, and Marshall was, like Wyndham Lewis, the Menippean satirist. There's a statement by Corinne in one of those interviews where she says when they're together, they have kind of a silly sense of humor. You remember that quote?
Mm-hmm.
They do silly joking.
Yeah.
I understand that. I think that's the way Carol and I are. I see that as Veronian. Lewis, I don't know how he joked with his wife, but so I don't know if I would consider McLuhan as coldly cynical as Lewis was. I found McLuhan personality-wise a quite happy guy, you know, and mm-hmm. always got energy and stuff. He wasn't morose or depressed. Occasionally he would be in the 78-79. George Thompson tells a story. They're talking in 78-79, they're at the Coach House, and they're talking to the guy who put together the bibliography, the guy down in Florida, forget his name.
Yeah.
Bob somebody.
I forget his name too.
Yeah. And George said, when Bob asked him, this guy in Florida says, "How you doing? How's it going up there?" "Well, it's just me and George now." Like, you know, he was being harassed, and everybody was ignoring him. And it was getting close to Trudeau losing his prime ministership, so he lost that connection to Ottawa in May 79. And then he has his stroke in September. So you see, Marshawn and those guys say that Marshawn got depressed in the 70s and wasn't his techno-optimist that some people thought he was in the 60s. I don't see that. But he was dealing with being isolated, probably really isolated, more than ever before in 78, 79. At least George's anecdote said that. I went to every human. I went to every anthropomorphic seminar every Monday since like 72. I went to all of them. And in 78, 79, okay, Trudeau comes in November 77. I had been in California for 2 months with Carolyn. She was on elective, and that's when I met Mary McLuhan. And so we come back, and it's like November 22nd or something. And so the first Monday after that, we're sitting there, and the famous appearance of Trudeau shows up. And so they had a picture in the paper the next day. McLuhan was back in the limelight of some kind of favoritism, you know, the grace of Trudeau shining on him. That was that's beginning of 77-78 season. And by January 78, nobody's coming anymore. He had that flash. It was the last flash, and what he calls swan song or the supernova. And I would start bringing friends, and it would just be me and my friends and a couple other regulars, nobody who was an academic. They actually became friends of me and Carolyn, these stragglers, you know. but they weren't. I didn't bring them, but they all showed up, and it was amazing. It was just us with McLuhan, and he still talked and did his thing. There was one woman from California who he favored. She was a smart PhD candidate or something, but she wasn't that involved with the center right then. But McLuhan complimented her a lot. So she was the brightest in the normal sense of having academic ideas and stuff to throw back at McLuhan. And he liked that. You know, he didn't like people who agreed with him. He liked people who argued with him. So, but it was very bleak through 78. Then we were supposed to start in October 79, but he had a stroke. And then Eric started maybe in November. We got two or three sessions, and we ended in December 3rd or so. And I told you about how the last session I brought Walter Boert, the Operation Mind Control. So 79 into 80 never got going, really. So we ended in the spring of 78, and I would go down. I even got to the point where I'd go down to the coach house, and McLuhan would give me assignments. he always liked assigning things to people. So they'd go maybe get some research, do something, bring it back, and he'd take whatever they got. So he told me, did I ever tell you this? Does this sound familiar?
A little bit.
Okay, maybe I told you this.
Interesting.
Yeah, he told me to go to England and look up A.L. Rouse, R-O-W-S-E, who is listed as a writer in the bibliography in Gutenberg Galaxy, I think. Yeah, because there's no bibliography in Understanding Media. Is there? I don't think so. Maybe.
I don't think so, no.
Yeah. So there's a long one in Gutenberg Galaxy. So you look up Rouse, R-O-W-S-E, and he's a famous historian or something, right? He had a lot of status.
Yeah.
And so he wanted me to go over and talk and somehow interact with Rouse. But then I was to go down to, what's the Shakespeare place? Abingdon or Avon or something on the beach?
Yeah, Stratford.
Stratford on something, right?
On Avon, yeah.
Yeah. I haven't thought about these ideas. See, that's how far away we are in this Android meme, multi-encyclopedic, multiple information environments. I'm amazed at things I forget because I got a lot of other stuff to think about now. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
Millions of things. So he wanted me to go there, and he says the families that knew Shakespeare are still there. And so there's an oral tradition of anecdotes about Shakespeare. We need to record those. We need to go find the families that trace themselves back for 400 years or so and interview them and see what the oral tradition has preserved. And so that was my assignment in 78 or early 79. And then on Hitler's birthday, April 20th, 79, I was sitting in the coach house again, and McLuhan, someone comes in, George says, here, you got to take the phone. So he takes the phone in the front desk right beside me. I'm sitting at the front desk, and he's at the inner part of the front desk where George would be, and he takes the phone, and he holds it up to his ear and covers it. And he starts whispering in the phone so I couldn't hear it. But he's doing this right in front of me, like that I can see that he's trying to for me not to hear it. And so he does this muffled conversation with the CIA or something for a few minutes, then hangs up. And so then I was sitting there with a book on Ezra Pound by a David Hemming or something, and it was called The Last Rower. But what was interesting, they had the transcripts of Pound's broadcasts on Mussolini radio in World War II. I don't think we had seen that before. No one had gone and gone through them and typed out the transcripts. So he says, what do you got there? So I hand him the book, and he ridiculously pries open the pages very carefully, peering at the numbers, and then he opens to a page and he reads it. Now, I didn't know about him going to page 69 at that point, right? I don't know where that came out, how we found out later. Maybe Barry Nevitt told us. Barry told us a lot once Marshall was gone. And so he did it with the book. He wouldn't look at anything. He just squeezed open the pages until he got real, real close up to his face until he saw 69. Then he'd open it up and read what was on there. So that was, so he was very strange to me that day. And but then years later, I found out, oh, that's what he was doing, looking up page 69. And so then he just looks at the book for a little bit and then gives it back to me. And then I don't remember much happening after that. He went back to his office, and then I left. And then the next time, the last time I see him is, say, about June. And I'm walking down George Street, across College, and down McCall Street to go to the health food store called Baldwin Foods on Baldwin Street. And at the corner of the lights, there's George and Marshall driving up McCall and going to cross College and go up George Street past Fort Book, you know, Robarts Library. And George is in his old clunky car. And as they're driving across and I'm walking, I'm looking at them. I recognize them first. Then George sees me, and he signals to Marshall to look. And Marshall looks at me. I'm on my bike. And he starts laughing, kind of a mocking laughing at me. And then they go past me and drive up. But I felt that McLuhan was laughing at me for being a bicyclist in Toronto. And that's my last image of McLuhan. I never saw him again because 2 months later he was gone.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, Bob, if I understood correctly, you were saying that from 1972 until 79, whenever you were in Toronto, you were going to the Monday night seminars, and then later, beginning sometime in the middle 70s, I guess, you also began to spend appreciable time at the Coach House when there weren't seminars. You were just there.
Yeah, yes, because I gradually moved to Toronto. In 72, 73, 74, I could stay at my friend Don McBrady's. So I could drop into Toronto anytime, and I dropped in a lot, say, from October to April when he was doing his winter season seminars. But in that period, as you know, he was ill. He went on vacations here and there, or travel around the world. So it wasn't every Monday. So I didn't have to be there every week, just whenever he was in town.
Mm-hmm.
But by 77, we're living in Toronto. And so it was easy the last 3 years to attend everyone.
But I think what I was getting to is I think it would be interesting to listeners to have your kind of history of going to these seminars starting in 72.
Yeah.
And learning how you participated in them. It's hard for me to believe that Bob Dobbs could just have been sitting there all these years only taking stuff in.
That's what I did. I tell you, I did not speak. I spoke once around 77. He was talking about myth, and I said, well, what about the myth of the myth, which is sort of a pun. And he said, that's a mirror image. Something like that. That's double talk or a mirror image, and dismissed it. And it was so distracting to prepare a statement, then see his reaction, and then watch everybody else's reaction to me reacting. I wanted to hear everything he said, and I found that would knock out my attention. So I never said a word again. I recorded in my mind everything he said. There's a lot of stuff if you get me into talking, I can remember conversations and guests and what people said and different things. So I got a good oral memory of all that. But that's because I paid pure attention to it.
But certainly you weren't, I mean, you're not a person to, you know, be too nervous or too uptight or something to make comments. So you must have had this kind of programmatic approach to what was going on.
I think they Marshall, he knew me, but he got suspicious around 77, 78, because George, I remember it was before Trudeau. So in 77, I come in to go to the talk, and he says, Bob, I want to talk to you after. So I think I had, before that, gone to St. Michael's and presented myself to the very strict, severe librarian in there, this lady, who guarded the Dewline newsletters. And I presented myself probably as a student of McLuhan or connected to McLuhan, and I got access to them and quickly Xeroxed them all. And that was great because nobody could get the Dewline newsletters. I don't know where anybody got them after. And then maybe they went to the library or something. But I had a full set, just like I had a full set of the expirations in the 60s in the graduate, the varsity graduate. So that was very good to get that stuff. And no one was reading McLuhan really in depth then. And I was, and I had the articles and everything, so I could see everything. I went the whole journey. If you had all the articles, you really knew a lot. If you just read McLuhan fragmentarily, you didn't get it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody has seriously read, especially the late stuff, as well as you have.
Right. No, that's true. And that's what I did when I got there in 77 was living. I spent a lot of time going to an incredible number of libraries all over Toronto, finding obscure articles by McLuhan because I had Mark Stewart's bibliography. And so my involvement with McLuhan was going ongoing in the late 70s, but my extra involvement with George and Margaret Stewart really gave me an extra advantage as a budding archivist. You know, they really helped me and gave me stuff that no one else has. So, but back to, so I get in there and I get the Dewline newsletter. And then within a week or two, I approach McLuhan at the end of a Monday night seminar. I'm just eavesdropping on him talking to somebody. And he could make himself tall or something. Or I felt he became taller. And he looked down at me and says, I understand you've been talking to, and he named the lady. And I said, yes. And, well, how's it going? I said, well, I got a copy of everything. It was really good. So he just sort of smirked and nodded, and he didn't say anything more. But he was telling me that he was on to me going around to people like that librarian and claiming to be associated with the coach house and getting access, right? So he just said, I know what you're doing. But he didn't complain. But he just wanted me to know that I was being discussed. All right? Yeah. Shortly after that, George says to me, I need to talk to you after the seminar. Now, I hope this echo, what the heck, is this going to be on the recording? You're hearing the echo, right?
Yeah, a little bit. I don't hear me. I hear you.
What is that? Maybe I got it too loud. The other phone. Hello?
Hello.
I'm going to... No, I'm not doing anything. I'm going to ignore the echo. Maybe it's not being recorded.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Maybe you want to do some kind of test because in the past we had that session where only the first half hour or something was recorded. And
no, that's why I have the echo, so I can hear the other phones, and then I know they're still being recorded. It stops recording if the other two drop off for some reason because it won't work with just one phone plugged in. You've got to have two phones. So, Maybe if I put the second. Maybe if I go upstairs, be further away. Let me try that. Hello? Yeah, it's not. No echo there, right?
A little bit, but certainly better than before.
Right, and what it does, I can't hear the echo if we're still going. That's the problem. You know, I'd like to have the echo slightly in the background so I can hear that all phones are on. But that's too much right now. So I'm upstairs here and got to shut the window so the neighbors don't hear.
Mm-hmm.
They're sleeping.
Sure.
Okay, so.
Can you see the ocean from up there?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
I'm looking over the, sometime in the daylight, I'll show you the view on my computer. You know, I'll hold the computer up there and you can see it. So I come to George. He asked to see me. So I come to him after the seminar and he looked at me and says, "Nah, never mind, Bob." So he stopped. He didn't pursue it. But I was suspicious. Mm-hmm. They were wondering, what was I doing? Because I was such a... I mean, nowadays I'd be called a troll. A guy shows up, or a stalker, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else showed up every week and didn't say anything. That's a very suspicious character, I think, from normal perception. I wasn't trying to be. I was actually being the most attentive person, you know. And I just forgot. I'm going to have to get the computer, go back down and get the computer when we start doing the text. But maybe we'll be talking about other things. So then the next time George asked for a copy of my inventory that I had from Mark Stewart of the bibliography, and I told you about that, and then when I became the archivist after Marshall died, and I worked with Mrs. McLuhan, that's when I found in Box 22 the file with a copy of my inventory with everything checked off that I had, and it said Bob Dallas McLuhan Archivist. So I was sort of accepted. I see. George must have said, "Okay, what is Bob doing? Why is he always here? He didn't say anything." Oh, yeah, and I remember when Trudeau came, the whole time that Trudeau's there sitting in the little room with McLuhan and Barry Nevitt and Bob Logan up there at the front, George Thompson was standing in the doorway. It's dim in the seminar room, light in the back in the front office, where his office. So he's standing in the light, so he's kind of in shadow but also lit up in some strange way. And he spends the whole time, the Trudeau's there, staring at me. After a while, I was like, he's still looking at me. So I don't know what they thought. They thought maybe I was a terrorist and would jump on Trudeau or something, but it was ridiculous. The way he blatantly stared at me with his arms crossed, waiting for me to make a move or something. And then years later, Michael Edmonds told me he became a friend of George Thompson's, and Thompson said he once caught me going up the side stairway trying to sneak into McLuhan's office upstairs. Now, I know I never did that. I wouldn't do that. I don't know if there was nothing up there for me to get because Mark Stewart would give me anything. So I said, that's a projection on someone else. But George was very definite about it, and Mike and I had joked about it because Mike believed me that I did not go up there. But that shows you that he had a problem with me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my last encounter with George before he died, the McLuhan Centenary. Yeah, was it the Centenary, which is 2011? No, Andrew was in New Zealand. In 2004, Andrew was, I met Andrew Crystal. He was in Ottawa at the Archives for 6 months. Then he came to Toronto, and we hung out together. And he gave a talk. And this is in October. He's a fellow at the coach house there. And I asked Andrew some questions during his talk. And then I hear later, Andrew tells me, or someone, maybe Michael Edmonds again, said that George said, "Bob is insufferable. I can't take that guy. I mean, man, is he pompous?" And I'm not being pompous. I'm not that type of person. I don't think I wasn't trying to be pompous. I was talking to Andrew because he's a friend, and I was interested in his topic. And there weren't many people asking questions. But there again, there's George complaining about me, ridiculously. So I end up being more connected to Mark Stewart after Marshall died, not George Thompson. Maybe George was pissed off that I didn't hang out with him.
No. Yeah. Did she ever recover from her broken hip?
Never did.
No, I didn't think so, yeah.
And so that was very depressing for her. So she's laid up from 78. And we were in New York about 19, went to New York in 93. And about 94, Jim Stewart called me and said Margaret had passed on. So she was, you know, that would be 16 years of just having to sit around all day and limp about to go into the kitchen or something. But she was laid up for a long time, 16 years.
Mm.
So she probably just deteriorated because I stopped seeing her by the late 80s and was very busy on the radio and then went to New York.
Yeah.
So what else to tell you? You want me to say some things about the seminar?
Well, I was just interested in finding out what kind of interaction you had because...
My interactions with McLuhan were private. I would meet him in his office at odd hours when no students were around, and I'd talk to him about my intelligence work and all the different things, and he found it very interesting. And maybe
this is good to hear. I'm glad we got onto this topic. He wasn't incredulous or...
No, he knew I knew stuff.
new stuff about the world.
Yeah.
His stuff.
And I like to think that... remember Eric in Marchand's book, I think. He says, my father was still into conspiracies of Freemasons in 76. And Eric says, I told him to knock it off or something. You know, stop being paranoid.
Yeah, he wrote him a letter about it.
Yeah, something like that. And so that's Eric. But
right.
I would say that it wasn't worrying about the Freemasons. The kind of information I had, which nobody knew that he was interested until they got the Hydro Forces interview where he talks about the Kennedy assassination and blatantly says the establishment killed him, and he said for very good reason. They were trying to change the structure there, do something in the White House. And he said, you can't do that when you're up against Big Brother, which in Gutenberg Galaxy, he says, goes inside, right? They're not strutting around outside like in the 30s in Nazi Germany. They're gone inside. And he's fully aware of that. And when I got talking to Carpenter in the 90s in New York, he talked a lot about the CIA taking over anthropology in the early 50s. And he and Marshall, in a way, invented the media discourse to create an environment to conventional criticism because they knew intelligence agencies were managing media way differently from the old spy versus spy stuff.
Right. No question about that. But
right.
On the other hand, they had zero success in that aim.
Oh, you mean Marshall and
Carpenter.
Oh, yeah. And it made Ted very bitter. He was very bitter even till the final days. And he would... He kind of complained about Marshall blowing it. They could have done better in their infiltration project if Marshall hadn't been so silly and didn't have the brain problem, you know, in the 67.
Yeah.
You know, you read different reports by Carpenter. He says Marshall was not performing well when he spoke in New York to the big audiences. And I've heard recordings of them. I do not hear that, what Carpenter hears. Marshall's, he's being himself. He says some serious stuff, then he throws a joke or two in. But unless we don't hear the particular talk, we don't have a recording of it, when he's quoted saying Marshall was so ridiculous that night, in Tony Schwartz's recordings, the way it's described in the book, it seems to be the conference, the YMCA or something that we have on tape. So never got that clarified what Carpenter was talking about. But Carpenter was pissed off at Marshall for even just being seen and with Hubert Humphrey.
Uh-huh.
And I think he mentioned
that. Yeah, that makes sense. And he may have been referring to the fact that as McLuhan got sicker and sicker in the 60s and was really pretty sick for the whole Fordham time, he became very repetitive.
Yeah.
Right? And Carpenter says somewhere in one of his essays about McLuhan that prior to 1960, which is when McLuhan had his first serious stroke,
yeah,
that McLuhan was a sort of Muhammad Ali figure.
He was very charismatic. Yeah, incredibly.
That's right. He had so much magnetism,
yeah,
and so much energy would flow towards him just sort of by going into a room. And I think that Carpenter placed a lot of hope in that figure,
yeah,
which may never have been in the whole of who McLuhan was. May have been a little bit of a construction on Carpenter's part.
Yeah.
But at any rate, after 1960, according to Carpenter, that side of McLuhan was largely gone.
Yeah.
And for Carpenter, that represented not only a loss of something and a friend that he greatly valued, it also represented a demise of a hope in Carpenter himself.
That's right. See, Carpenter had a TV show in Toronto in the mid-50s, so he was a public figure. He then had an affair with somebody, and it was a scandal. So then he left Toronto, divorced his wife, and went to Toronto, went to California, I think.
And Northridge.
Right, he started to teach there. Now he's doing his own thing, and he becomes part of the counterculture and gets equipment for the underground filmmakers. He's actively involved in what McLuhan is commenting on from a distance. McLuhan was aware of all these, but he would write and comment. Well, Carpenter was right in the middle there helping to make this, quote, art, right? All this new art. So he removed himself from the McLuhan circuit that early, the late 50s. Maybe Marshall was showing symptoms in 59, but Carpenter, he's in California, he's not going to see that. But he did know about Marshall after the whatever happened in the hospital, because that's when Carpenter says, McLuhan said to him, "I wish I'd died. I'd finish my God's work." And Carpenter was shocked at that. But Carpenter was still an intimate friend that McLuhan would say something like that to, but he wasn't around anymore. And
right. But he was not so distant that when McLuhan asked him if he wanted to go to New York, when McLuhan went to Fordham, Carpenter came.
Well, Carpenter's going to take advantage of that. And his in Tony Schwartz recordings, which is on my website, you know, he gives a talk during that winter. And it's a very powerful talk, but he's talking like he's more important than McLuhan or something. He is not playing up to McLuhan like Harley Parker did or anybody else. He gives this very, very incredible talk and says insights that we never heard from McLuhan. he made a really important one. He said books were now the anti-environment, and only the alienated or the dropouts would read books, which is interesting.
And
because, you know, people who read Norman Mailer and Ginsberg or Brautigan and all these different people were university dropouts or guys hanging out in the beatnik scene. It's an important observation he made, that actually books were now an anti-environment. And that was the counterculture. And the problem with the counterculture, they were trying to retrieve the book stuff, and that gets into Gnosticism. And that's what they didn't understand what McLuhan was saying. McLuhan was too apparently anti-book for the book retrievers. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So Carpenter, his talk is very interesting.
Great. I think that I could be wrong, but my memory is that this was a talk that McLuhan was scheduled to give, but he had his brain operation.
Yes.
And then couldn't fill that slot, and Carpenter took it.
Yeah, so, it's early, like January, February, when McLuhan would still be convalescing.
Yeah.
And so
Carpenter may have thought that he was kind of speaking in McLuhan's name, and then that could very easily have slipped a little bit into sort of Carpenter's McLuhan.
Yeah. And there's a statement in there where Carpenter says, well, I'm heading out of here tomorrow. I don't think he was there. He flitted about, dropped in and out. You know what I mean? He was a little more autonomous than the rest of them in the setup at Fordham. Now, I think Paul Ryan was the assistant of Carpenter, but he's no longer with us, but he could have told us how much Carpenter did or was involved. On one of the recordings, you get the impression he's just dropped in, he's given a talk, and he'll be heading back somewhere to California or something. Not there all the time.
Carpenter certainly thought that he wasn't like the acolytes.
Right.
He wasn't. He thought that people like Harley Parker were just echoes.
Yep.
Were just sort of prop men for McLuhan. And he was certainly right that some of the conversations you hear, there's no actual dialogue going on. All there is prompting Marshall on some or other topic that they know he wouldn't mind talking about.
Right.
Right. Whereas Carpenter thought that he and McLuhan were sort of brothers, but not without their antagonisms.
Yeah.
And I think he felt that his relationship with McLuhan was sort of more masculine and
He was a Marine. Did you know that?
Actually, I did, yeah.
Yeah, and he was had a Marine sensibility, a tough guy, and he had helped the head of the Nuremberg trials, so he was aware of all whatever comes out in the Nuremberg trials, the secret Project Paperclip stuff. So he was a tough guy.
Yeah. And he was like Harold Innes in that he didn't just talk about, like Eskimos, for example, because he would go to the library and read a lot about Eskimos. He went up there and lived with them and suffered with them and tried to understand them from the inside.
Yeah.
And the same thing in New Guinea.
Yes.
So and actually he had all, you know, adventures all over the damn world.
He carried on right up to when he died. He was still going to Siberia and places.
That's right. And at one point, he and a group of his pals were caught trying to steal totem poles out of Haida Gwaii, Queen Charlotte Islands. And what they said was, well, yeah, we were trying to remove them, but we were trying to remove them and get them into conservation.
Yeah.
But the Haida said, no. I mean, and number one, these aren't your poles. These are our poles. And number two, they came out of nature and they go back to nature. So nobody, not even the Haida, are allowed to move them once they've been installed. And I think he came very close to being put in jail. The Mounties caught him.
Yeah, I don't know. I never heard of that story. Where is that laid out?
I'll find it for you and send you a link.
Is this when, those guys at Duke that started taking interest in Carpenter in his final years?
No.
Not
this
those guys.
Before they... that.
No, I'm saying they're not. They're the ones we might hear the story from.
Because... Oh, maybe, but... if we heard it from them, then I think it would be more complimentary than what my memory is of the story. My memory is that when Carpenter was caught and had to account for himself to the Mounties, that the story was pretty lame, that... Mm. He, in effect, admitted that he knew that this was against the law and that it was against Haida sensibility and that he shouldn't have been doing it.
Yeah, talking to Carpenter, and Derek reports the same experience when he tried to interview him for CBC in 1980, Derek couldn't take it. He says, Carpenter was so arrogant. It was all him and not Marshall kind of talk. But Carpenter did do the editing of Explorations. And he did that magazine article in 67, 68 for Harper's Bazaar that
yeah.
Buffoon was contracted, and he covered for that. And
mm-hmm.
he also helped with Understanding Media. So someone should be looking. Time now. He's been gone for a while. What, 10 years? I think he died in 2012. Where are his papers? Where are the
Correct.
Papers of his manuscripts of the Understanding Media that he contributed?
Correct. And where are all the letters that Marshall sent him?
Yeah, so...
You know, with people like Carpenter... Marshall would, when Carpenter was in California, Marshall's habit with people that he communicated with regularly was to write two or three letters a week.
Yeah.
And so Carpenter must have quite a supply, I would think,
right.
of letters somewhere, but I've never heard any indication of where his papers are preserved.
Right.
If they're preserved.
And I'm going to look at the Duke University and those guys that were making a center around him or a memorial at Duke University, I think it was. What was the other thing I was going to say? Can't remember. I considered... I knew that you had to hear everything that McLuhan was saying. It was always, he was always informing you of everything that he was thinking of. So it was important to listen to him all the time. So that's where I used the seminars as a classroom to really hear everything he said. And, you know, it was remarkable how mm-hmm. people had no clue. They didn't know the importance of what they were listening to.
Correct.
They were just, I don't know, tourists.
Well, they didn't know how to, they didn't have the interpretive apparatus to
yeah.
understand what they were listening to.
They
right? Whereas.
They didn't have to know the history. So, so I was going to say Carpenter, he's very critical of McLuhan after 60, 61.
Correct.
Especially when Gossage and those guys come in. He's very mad at McLuhan, and I think he felt superior to McLuhan. I think he felt McLuhan lost it and was immorally, becoming a little corrupt, which would surprise mm-hmm. Carpenter's image that he had of him, of McLuhan in the 50s. And in a way, ignoring McLuhan. And remember, he says in his article, he gives up on the whole media ecology thing by 1970, 71, and starts studying, preserving that famous anthropologist. He goes back to being an anthropologist, a specialist.
Right, right.
And stops doing the media ecology. Now, what he told me that when McLuhan got into the computer stuff that we started off talking about, well, not on the recording, we were talking earlier tonight about modulating the media environment globally, he said, you know, when Marshall got into that computer talk, he says, that was ridiculous. And I realized I appreciate Marshall when he was an aesthete in the 50s. He considered Marshall an aesthete of media, which is not completely accurate. But anyways, that aesthetic level was all that was Carpenter was interested in. And that's why he gravitates to the art world through his wife, who ran that family, the DIA Art Institute. And Carpenter's wife, his wife's sisters and brothers were very involved in the DIA thing. So he ended up in the art world. So I'm saying that Carpenter removed himself from the later McLuhan. He wasn't interested in that. And,
right. Which means that his understanding of the early McLuhan was also one-sided.
I think that's why he became bitter. He was, quote, unbalanced a little about it all. And embarrassed. He spent a lot, when I talked to him in the 90s, he complained a lot about everybody in the scene and Marshall himself. You know, like everybody blew it, and he was the designated survivor, the one who
but
kept.
But can't that attitude be run together a little bit with our? Ideas about McLuhan. I mean,
yes.
There's a great deal of potential in McLuhan that went utterly unrealized.
That's right. Yeah, we should stop calling. We're not McLuhanites. We're Carpenterites. A new school.
In a certain sense. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was a lot easier to talk to than McLuhan. He could he'd gossip more. McLuhan didn't gossip. He sticked strictly business. And once you had exhausted whatever you were going to offer McLuhan, he'd move on to someone else. You know, he didn't.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of fun gossiping about a lot of people in all kinds of scenes with Ted Carpenter. And did I tell you?
But that was in the 90s, right? Talking when you were in New York.
Yes. Yeah. And. Did I ever tell you that he became very suspicious of Tony Schwartz? Ever tell you that?
No.
Okay, so they're old buddies, you know, since the 60s or, you know.
Yeah. Go back 20 to 30 years.
Right. And when Carter was debating Reagan and something called Briefinggate happened, does that remind you of anything? Briefinggate?
Oh, vaguely.
Yeah, somebody leaked Carter's papers to Reagan, so it gave Reagan an edge in the debates. Carpenter tells me, I think Tony did that. Now, if you see a picture of Tony, he's got his bow tie on. He has that conservative look of the 70s, you know, the William Buckley look or something with these little dinky bow ties. He's like that in his image in the 70s. And so Carpenter said that that Schwartz was a double agent. He was working for the Republicans or became Republican or always was, and he didn't want Carter to be president. He wanted Reagan to be president. He wanted the Republicans to go in there, and that's the mood of neoconservatism was happening, so maybe Tony got involved with that a bit. And so he had access. He was working as a consultant to Carter. And he had access to the papers and slipped them over to the Reagan team. Now, Ted's telling me this. which if I was him, I wouldn't tell anybody that. And we weren't that close, right? I'm not his close friend or anything. I was amazed that he didn't mind saying this, because he knew I was talking to Tony Schwartz.
Interesting. Carpenter was well in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so...
Now, wait, now you're blurry. You've switched your mic. Yeah, something happened there.
Uh-huh. I changed the hand that I was holding the phone, and that may have...
Right, well, can you put it back?
Well, how is it now?
It's not perfect. You're a bit blurry.
Okay, how is it now?
Okay, it might be okay. Well, let's see. So what were you saying?
I was saying that Carpenter was in good health in the 90s, I believe.
Yes, he was.
I guess at that time he was involved with that German anthropologist whose papers he was collecting and publishing.
Yeah, Carl somebody.
Sending all over the world.
Yeah, Carl somebody. I forget his last name right now. Yeah, mm-hmm. He made he made some books, and he made
ten of them, I believe.
Yeah, was that Carl's stuff? Can't remember.
Yeah. Carpenter and his wife then, who were fabulously wealthy. Supplied the 10 volumes to libraries all over the world for free. I've never actually looked into one of them, but I've always had the idea that I should do that at some point.
I don't know. I've seen them. I don't know where I saw them, at some library or something in New York probably. But you want to get his book, Patterns That Connect, which is the summary of all those 10 volumes. You know, it's one volume.
Greatest Hits.
Beg your pardon?
Greatest Hits.
Greatest, no, not getting the words.
Greatest Hits. Am I,
you're
is there
blurry.
Something wrong with the phone or something?
On those words, I don't know, you're Greatest Hits. I don't know what you're saying. Anyways, this little book, Patterns That Connect, are you calling it something?
No, our connection is going in and out. I don't know if there's a problem here or a problem there, but I couldn't hear you there for a while.
Oh, wow. So I may not have got recorded?
I don't know, but you're saying that I'm coming across blurred.
Yeah, but you're now clear, but that phrase, Rate of Sith, that I can't figure out what you're saying. I'm talking about the book Patterns That Connect. So you can buy that book.
Greatest Hits.
Oh, Greatest Hits. Okay, Greatest Hits. Maybe I should go. I don't know. I'm just going to stay here because we get the echo if I go back downstairs. Greatest Hits of Carl's work.
Correct.
Yeah. So get that book.
Did you see? Yeah, no, I'll have to look at it. I haven't read it, so I'll have to do that. Yeah. I sent you some letters between McLuhan and a professor down in Florida. I believe the guy had started off at Yale, and McLuhan probably met him through Brooks and Wimsatt. I guess the guy was Catholic, and so then McLuhan and he started a kind of academic slash Catholic back and forth a little bit. And one of the letters is particularly interesting because McLuhan says that he thinks he has Carpenter near a conversion, and he asks the guy in Florida to pray for it.
What years is that?
That's the middle 50s.
Middle 50s, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that was his hidden agenda. He did it to Barry Nevin. Barry told me. Like, every now and then, if you were really working close with him, he would say, why aren't you a Catholic, Barry? He would, you know, confront them.
Uh-huh.
Every
now
and then.
I think that McLuhan genuinely believed that if you thought hard enough about what you were doing, then you would become a Catholic.
Yeah, you had to be.
Yeah, and not necessarily a Roman Catholic, right? I mean, he had great respect for the Eastern Church as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so just Catholic, you know, just do the conversion thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and here's, if he was doing it in the mid-50s, Carpenter was having an affair. It wouldn't be very Christian. So we're talking, we got into Carpenter, and because why? Oh, we're just talking about me being at the seminars. So, yes, I would, I could talk to Carpenter about political stuff, political conspiracies and scandals and more stuff that you never heard Marshall talk about. But when I met with him privately, I would tell him about mafia CIA stuff that I knew about, overlay, and he kept quiet when I said that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, he would have been very interested in what you were saying in regard to his notions about secret societies,
yeah.
Right? And his, I guess you could say his fear was that the propagandistic bent of technology was not a kind of technological accident. That it was also intended, and so he was very worried about that fact. Combined with the additional fact that whenever he talked about that, even with somebody like Eric, it was taken to be, you know, conspiracy theory and half nuts.
Yeah. No, he understood. Let's see. When we talked, it wasn't about Freemasons. It was about, his term for these guys was the triggermen.
Uh-huh.
And he said Kissinger was the top triggerman. He even talks about the triggermen in his letter to Pound, you know, June 22nd, 1951, where he says, I'm going
right.
to needle some ambulance. Does he say triggerman in that letter? I don't think so.
I don't know if it's that letter, but he certainly talks about triggerman in a letter to Pound in either 51 or 52.
Okay, so he mentions that word, because it doesn't show up again until 74 when he's talking about Kissinger in that
uh-huh.
New York Times op-ed. I don't see it anywhere else. But, yeah, he says, I'm going to needle the somnambulists, that's the people, and create a distraction on the sidelines for the, I guess, triggermen, he said. I'll have to look that up.
Mm-hmm.
So he talked to Pound about the secret societies, and he was interested in Gnosticism and all that stuff that he and Don Thiel studied. That's more of a almost an aesthetic thing that he's doing. But the crime of people, the decentralizing of power and Big Brother going inside, that is not necessarily under his rubric of Freemasonic aesthetics and secret doctrine. You know what I mean? He just saw that power could become hijacked. And he has that great article in 71, The Hijacking of Cities, Nations and Planets. That's what he's talking about.
Right. That's in the university exploration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's in 71. I'm talking to him about that stuff around that time. So.
Mm-hmm. And that's that is very interesting as it became a kind of collective thought for McLuhan that. Everything was hijacking.
Yeah.
Right. So real estate development is hijacking of people's space, hijacking of their perspective, hijacking of their rights, and any kind of business activity was a hijacking.
Yeah.
And then he began to think, well, consider the bells in the Middle Ages. There's a kind of hijacking of the common space here through the bells, but it's a different kind of hijacking. And so then he had to think of, well, if hijacking is kind of a universal activity, which on one end is a crime, and on the other end is a kind of liturgy, how does that work along the spectrum?
Well, that's the masked man. When he said masked man is not tribal or not only tribal, the increasing autonomy that the digital technology was giving people, that enabled hijacking. You could ride above an organization and get there in the top, or even, say, Secret Service people. They're in there in the a separate bubble and decentralized and not on the tribal barometer, thermometer, or transparency. There's a what I call the solar government. You could start floating around the planet and hijacking the planet. And that autonomy, which came with the tribal content, the actual environment, more and more as you get into the late 60s, is the homeopathic hijacking that individuals can do with the just having access to the computer environment and stealing funds. So the hijacking was the other half of the mass man. Mass man is not only collectively conscious and merged in the global membrane, they can be autonomous and, with the right resources, disconnect from the merger and float around it and hijack it.
Yeah, but not only hijack it. I mean, the masked man is, by definition, the nobody. The masked man is the man or woman between between embraces of different sorts of identity. So the mechanism of the masked man is always going on with everybody, and it can be misused for hijacking.
Yeah.
Or it can be expressed in conversion. And the one of the mysteries is to try to contemplate how these very different types of, I don't know, you can call it association, you can call it celebration even, how such differences arise and how they can understand each other. Those are very, very deep themes in McLuhan that at least as far as I've seen, almost nobody had an understanding of what he was getting into there.
Well, first off, when you say mass man in the blur of audio, it can become mask, M-A-S-K-E-D, mass man.
See, right.
Mass man, and the masked man would be the autonomous part of the tactile interplay between the merger of the global membrane, everybody into nobody, and becoming a super angel that can hijack whole systems.
Correct.
That would be
correct.
The masked man.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was trying to address, was the masked ED man.
Oh, okay.
The nobody.
All right.
Right, this is not, in my view at least, this is not something new with electricity. This is something that has always gone on for every human at every moment in time. But with electricity, we begin to be able to see how this works. We get the kind of distance that's necessary to focus on this. And then once focus is made, then it can be seen that the masked EV man, on the one hand, can be a hijacker, and on the other hand, can be a celebrant. And there's probably a whole range in between those. And the great mystery of humans is to try to understand how this elevation above the possibilities of human existence, how that works, right? How elevation can be, as you say, solidified into solar government or something.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, can be internalized as a kind of gift that doesn't make that, on the one hand, is a superiority, but it's not a sort of a sovereignty. It's a superiority that's a gift and that entails responsibility with it.
Did you say celebrant?
Yes.
Right. Just a minute. I'm going downstairs. Because I remember once, I think I came upstairs, and it can tend to disconnect the phone. So,
wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah,
can you hear your echo?
Okay. Hello?
I heard something, but I don't know if it was an echo. Hello?
Yeah, one phone's working.
Okay, good.
Okay, now maybe I've got that on speaker.
I can hear your echo now.
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, very strong.
Hello?
Hello?
But I'm right beside it. I put on a speakerphone. Hello? That's even louder.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I'm taking that off the... Well, at least that didn't... That means we're still being recorded, so that's good. But the other one doesn't seem to be... Hello?
Yeah,
it's still going. Okay, so... what did I do before that we didn't have this echo problem? I don't know why it's happening.
I don't hear it now.
Oh, you don't?
No. Well, now I do. Jesus.
Okay, but so if I go over here, no echo? Yeah, it's less there.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Okay, so I wanted to add something about that. You're talking about the anthropomorphic physical. This is another aspect of the anthropomorphic physical. If you look at the tiny note chart, in the bottom corner is Rumpelstiltskin.
Correct.
And I have the relationship between the two charts is in that quadrant, whereas the relationship among the senses is in the other four, which are above the anthropomorphic physical in the linear layout. So the anthropomorphic physical, the Rumpelstiltskin is the hijacker. That's what I meant by it. And McLuhan used to say that if you could name something, you could control it. Well, what do you name the Android meme or what my chart is showing? So I used to say that my chart was the name. It was the components that made up the naming. You had to make a chart to name it.
That's a good insight, because what I hear you saying there is that you need something that's complicated and subject to investigation in order to name something.
Yeah.
And I like that.
And simple words is not enough. You got to show
Correct.
The environmental alchemy or the environmental factors, and that's what I'm showing. I'm showing what you call the elements of the environment. And so the Rumpelstiltskin takes advantage of other people projecting the anthropomorphic physical. In that sense, the Rumpelstiltskin is not human, not anthropomorphic. And maybe that's what postmodernism is trying to get at, that impersonal obliteration of the anthropomorphic that they call post-human, but I would take Thiel's term and say para-human and include these environments because the digital is post-analog. They should be saying we're para-analog or para-digital, not post-human or post-modern. That those are too limited for the complexity of the postness that we're in, if there is a postness.
Yeah, no, I prefer para.
Right.
Because that doesn't necessarily implicate the linear in the way that post does.
Right. Okay, so I've added that bit more to the anthropomorphic physical. That completes what I imagined I was doing. I would just say, in reference to my seminars, going to the seminars, it was very crowded, 70, 71, 72, like it was 67, 68, 69. But he got ill in 72, and when he came back, the charisma was gone, so to speak. People weren't going to the seminars very much in 73, 74, 75, 76. It wasn't as bad as 78, 79, but there weren't many people coming constantly other than a few students like Carl Scarf, who wasn't a student, but he was around working at Innes College as the editor of their paper. So there were core people that weren't my, quote, circle that were there, but they weren't always there. And I would say that I attended most of them because Eric was gone for a couple of years at different points. And Derek wasn't always around. Barry was pretty regular, but he would miss in the early 70s. He wouldn't attend all the time because he had his own business career going on, so he couldn't make it. But by the late 70s, Barry never – he was basically retired. He's still a consultant in a way, but he was retired, so he showed up every week and was even available for our organization. What we did after Marshall passed away, we carried on with Derek as the coach house got reopened in 83. So otherwise, I can quote people, different characters that came through and what McLuhan did with them. If it occurs to me. So,
yeah, but did when you were with McLuhan in his office
by himself,
and you're talking about the CIA or something like this, was he asking you questions or only listening?
He would ask a few questions, but he would act as if he already knew it, what I was telling him, you know? I was just confirming, validating what he suspected. I mean, his Watergate as theater is an amazing cover-up. He comes up with a way to talk about the bottom-up, I call it the bottom-up implications of everything. And as Mary said, Marshall used to tell her, don't confront them. Don't confront the CIA directly. You know what I mean? So he would make some interesting patterns for the somnambulists and talk about Watergate as theater and talk about patterns. But the actual manhunt, which in interviews in 72, 73, he would talk about the information hunt and the manhunt. And the manhunt was his term for the top-down Big Brother CIA world. And the manhunt was trying to find out who was in charge, who had hijacked the environment, the global situation. So the Secret Service and the CIA and everybody else all over the world, we're constantly trying to find out who were the new hijackers. So that's the manhunt. So he never.
Who are the rival hijackers?
Yeah. And So he would, oh, there's the echo. Why did that come in? You hear that? Suddenly there's
yeah.
an echo.
All of a sudden I do.
Maybe someone's tapping us. It's a sign that, anyways, in a couple of interviews, in public interviews, he uses the term manhunt, but he hardly ever says it. But that's important. He said, at one point, he said, Watergate. You see, that echo isn't there now.
Yeah.
He said, now it's back, but Watergate was a manhunt. And, but he didn't use the word manhunt in his articles on Watergate. That was only said when he was being interviewed on TV or something. So, again, the medium determined what he would say. Why would he say manhunt on TV? Well, the content of the Global Theater was all about humans as content. Remember, he said man is still the content, page 11 of Take Today. So the search for who is or what is in charge is part of the anthropomorphic physical. Is there a human at the core, at the switchboard? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's
yeah,
not. Maybe
absolutely.
There's aliens there or something.
So, but that's what you're saying there, I think, or at least one of the things I hear you saying is that the anthropomorphic is not only a style, not only an orientation, not only a form, it's also a question.
Yeah. I got the questions. You guys got the answers. I got the questions. Remember, Claude used to say that. So, that my chart is a question, but there's a lot of answers in there too. You got to have both.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, maybe that's why we can't make a finish line. We can't determine whether we've got all the answers. We got a lot of answers. Is that enough?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that when McLuhan said there are no finish lines, that he was right.
Yeah.
That if you think of, chemistry as an example, the reason that it's able to learn more and more and more about things is that there's never a finish line to its investigations.
That's right. So... maybe we should go to the tech body and anybody dialogue now.
Okay.
I should
stop in around 20 minutes, around 7:30 our time.
Okay.
Because I need to take some medicine, but between now and then I'm fine.
Right. The just wondering if I could say something else. So. When I was doing the private interaction with McLuhan about whatever I had to contribute, I liked him in that situation. He was not putting on the professor. He wasn't being a teacher. He was mm-hmm. the natural inquisitive genius or, a person knows there's more to find out. He wasn't arrogant. Is he,
how would you start off? Would you see him in his office and knock on the door and say, can I come in for a minute? Or would it be set up ahead of time? Or
I'd make an appointment. Would drop in sometimes casually, but if I wanted, I felt I had something to tell him, I'd make an appointment. So it was more formal.
And make an appointment through Marge?
Yeah. And, of course... if anybody else was there, I might not have got in because I wasn't a student or anything. But Marg liked me and knew me and knew what I talked to Marshall about because I talked to her a bit about it. So it was thanks to Marg that I could be that way, have a formal appointment. Yep, so basically I'd come in and he'd sit there, okay, Bob, what are you going to give me? That kind of attitude. I mean, I took time off to meet you, and I know you want to tell me something, so I would tell him. And then he would respond as if, yeah, I figured as much or something like that. You know, yes, I knew that. And I would keep trying to come up with something that would make him be quiet for a second. And sometimes I would.
If he was quiet, that would indicate he was thinking about it?
Yeah, he had not anticipated it.
Mm-hmm.
It was new information for him. So as the late 70s, why was there this shift of George being suspicious of me? Now, you can see the more he found out about me. I don't know if Marshall told him the kind of conversations we had. But maybe he did, and George, in a quote, immaturely, got suspicious of me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's possible. I don't know the answer. But.
No, you don't. But I'm just saying that may be the change in his attitude towards me, and why he would stare at me the whole time Trudeau was there, wonder what's Bob going to do here. You know. So
yeah,
I'm thinking
he was.
What?
He wanted to make sure that you didn't do anything that would upset the apple cart.
Yes. He said, basically, don't continue your policy of shutting up, Bob. Don't say a damn word.
and don't move.
Yeah. Don't make any quick moves. Okay, so we're at the point in page 184, right?
Yes, sir.
The manuscript here. Or the pamphlet or the book, 184, we talked about power and Tech Body screaming at anybody. Anybody's interviewing Tech Body, but it's actually me, and it's recorded, and it's the first interview with the Tech Body. Tech Body's gotten rather unruly during the shows now, which is a whole interesting dimension that's going on. So we're at the point, who is wielding, if we aren't, where do we get? We got to go into the power part. You're ridiculous, and you don't know what you're doing, and you're doing it anyway, and you think you're watching TV, but the TV's watching you. Did we do that?
Yes. And that's one of the subtopics that we've been talking about all day today.
Right. Okay, so then anybody responds to that by going, so that, and then it's not sure where to go. So the Tech Body says, now, we're going to decide what you watch. Anybody says, exactly what you have said, that we've given up our power to do those things. Tech Body says, yeah, anybody, to something else. So I finish the sentence, that we've given up our power to do those things to something else. Tech Body says, correct. Anybody, so that's something else. Tech Body interrupts me and says, now the powerful humans are left to drive this new Tech Body that's very powerful, very powerful. Anybody says, if it's not a physical machine, what is it? Tech Body says, power.
Yeah. Now, we should just back up for a minute.
Yeah.
When at the start of the page with the You're Ridiculous passage.
Yeah. What about it? Looks like camera got cut off. Hello? Let me check this. Hello? Hello? Maybe one of the phones went dead. Hello? That one's still open. Cameron, are you there?
Did you get cut off? Wasn't recorded. I didn't hear that. Suddenly you were. So let's go back. Let's see if this works. I'm going to go back in.
And let's see. You can hear the echo. Hello?
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 We seem to be reconnected.
Very faint.
Am I faint?
Yeah. I've got my phone on as loud as possible, but you sound...
Yeah, you're a bit blurry, too. Well, I'm not faint now, am I?
Oh, no, not there. You sound better.
Right. So let's just see if we can get a few sentences in here. So,
okay.
What were you saying about power?
I can hear the echo back there.
You can hear the echo.
Yeah.
Okay. So what were you saying that we didn't hear about power?
I was saying that the
ridiculous.
When the tech body says, now the powerful humans are left to drive this new tech body. Right? One reading of that would be Facebook or Twitter or Microsoft or something where some individual humans have extraordinary power compared to the rest of us because they're able to drive this tech body. But we have to read that in terms of what was said in the passage about you're ridiculous.
Yes.
And the you're ridiculous is you don't know what you're doing. You're doing it anyway. You think you're watching TV, but the TV is watching you. So if we use that tool to read this sentence about the powerful humans are left to drive this new tech body, what that turns out to be is you're ridiculous. You think you're driving the new tech body, but the tech body is driving you.
Yeah. And did the idea that the Google and those guys, Silicon Valley, Zuckerberg, are running the show beyond governments, that's the autonomous part of the late stages of the analog phase and then the beginning of the digital analog interplay, and Massman has got this autonomous hijacker potential. Google and them are the hijacking part, which anthropomorphic physical would think is CIA people or some cabal, becoming an environment. So the autonomous part of the interplay between Massman and Mask, M-A-S-K-E-D man, becomes a figure as an environment since 2012 when they talk about surveillance capitalism. And nobody can control Zuckerberg and these guys. And they don't seem to care whether we don't respect them or not. And that would be the attitude of the, quote, CIA people. They wouldn't care if the locals didn't respect them. So our digression into the CIA talk and the autonomous aspect of masked man logically follows into what we're saying right here with the tech body.
Yep.
Yes, the tech bot. The big brother goes inside, becomes an environment. Now, that's why it's machinic. Not a machine, but the tech body is in charge because it's running the humans, the mass men, who think they're running it.
Yep.
All right. So, yep.
And the secret of doing that is the masked man.
Yeah.
The M-A-S-K-E-D, because the modern technologies are able to be as powerful as they are because they have found the secret of human identity and human communication. They may not understand what they're able to manipulate, but they're able to manipulate it.
And that's so, the statement in 1954 in Catholic Humanism.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, they've hijacked the creative process, the process of how you make
correct.
Culture.
That is correct. And if they didn't do that, they wouldn't be successful.
Right, and the making of culture is keeping the TV going, keeping the media environment going, and everybody has to struggle to keep up. And he says to Tony Schwartz back in the 60s, just knowing what's going on is your main job.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and in the future of an automated environment, that will be our only jobs.
Our own what?
Our only job.
Yes. So we become shepherds.
Yeah.
So the mask, M-A-S-K-E-D men are the first shepherds. They're doing what McLuhan outlined in the Playboy interview, but that statement was too much about the forms of analog media. The modulating of information, or basically what the White House says, is the programming that McLuhan suggested could be done, but he was still thinking in bulk and machinic environments. The ethereal, super-embodied, super-angelic and making of consciousness every day by, quote, the media, is the tech body manipulation, what I call pentadic as opposed to tetradic, programming that he's getting at in books like Take Today. Like on page 11, he says, man becomes figure and ground in an information situation. So McLuhan is seeing the word makes the market, and the patterning of that is the final hijacking, and it gets 40 years later, well, 50 since 1970, it's hard to tell whether it's human or not.
Correct.
So let's just see what Ion says, or the tech body says, and Ion's embedded in there. Tech body says, now the powerful humans are left to drive this new tech body that's very powerful, very powerful. And I go, if it's not a physical machine, what is it? He should say, it should say about this patterning of the word makes the market, but it's a word that's changed every 6 hours kind of thing. So if it's not a physical machine, what is it? He says power, and that's the power to make a pattern and impose it on people or to make them think they have to adjust to it. And I go, who is wielding the power if we aren't? Tech body says, yes, the humans sacrificed or separated themselves from their power because they wanted something smarter than they to run the ship. And so they got it. They asked for it, and they got it. So the humans created the tech body, and they continue, dot, dot, dot. Now, AI, or artificial intelligence, which isn't very artificial anymore, makes its own artificial intelligence. It can run every potential outcome. It takes all probability out of the conversation. See, the conversation is the tactile interplay of the information society, right? So it hijacks the conversation. So anybody says, right, so the AI is like we used to say, quote, the robots are going to take over. So the robots, dot, 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 and the tech body interrupts and says, now the robots are taking over themselves. The robots are getting rid of the robots to make better robots. So now it's amazing. Now, maybe for the first time, the tech body is morphed into this new Wi-Fi inference. Now, if inference is not being precise, then we're in a society today where nobody knows what's going on, and you hear people complain about this more and more because they can't get to even finish the sentence. So I used to say that Trump could barely finish his sentences, but Biden can't even finish his syllables. So that's the inference squared. You know what I mean? We can't decide what's being inferred. And then the tape body says, it makes a whole other level to play, which almost obfuscates Herbert Marsh McLuhan. Aha! An important point. Almost. Less and except he said, quote, he said McLuhan said, look out, this is what you're going to get. And you have all the quadrants. That's pretty smart application of my chart. Look out, this is what you're going to get. Now, the tech body says McLuhan was the closest to predicting the tech body. So they're all saying the same thing, says the tech body, even LaRouche. They're all saying the same thing. Look out, look out, look out. You don't know what you're dealing with, unquote. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, everybody's fighting fire to pump more and more and more and more and more input dash information dash power into this thing. That's what I was trying to say a minute ago. The word that makes the market move from bulky environments, you know, television forms of the 60s, to the ethereal superembodied information patterning. And the tech boys come up with a new statement. It's input hyphen information power. Who gets to put the input into where the White House was? That's where we're at now. And that explains why, because this whole thing is to explain Trump, why Trump can say he's still president. And the Biden people will insist Biden is a better president and doing great. But half the non-Biden world says, no, Biden is horrible. He blew it with Putin and all this stuff. You know, you get all these, well, basically the dialectic, you know, Fox versus CNN in trying to find out what's being inferred. Where are we at? So I say, or anybody says, when you say Wi-Fi inference, are you, and then I'm interrupted, tech party says, yes. You can't live in a house now without Wi-Fi. Or he asks this question, yes, you can't live in a house now without Wi-Fi? Before you could live in a house without electricity. Now you can't live in a house without Wi-Fi. Forget electricity. Anybody goes, right, right, as if anybody's understanding it. Tech body says, your human existence now based on bandwidth, not on information. Bandwidth. Anybody says, right. Bandwidth is how fast you can interact with the people you're interacting with. Tech body, that's right. That's exactly right. And anybody says, yes. Tech body says, very good. Perfect algorithms that are always correcting themselves. Let's stop there. That's pretty impressive what's being said here in light of all that we've been saying.
That's right. So if we just go back for a minute, bandwidth is how fast you can interact with the people you're interacting with. Then tech body says, that's right. That's exactly right. I think one of the things that the tech body means there is that the word fast, how fast you can interact with the people, the word fast there needs to be taken not only in terms of acceleration and speed, it also needs to be taken in terms of the quality and the range of possibilities over which you can interact with people. And that gives a whole other sense to bandwidth.
Yeah, that's right. I hope you were leading to explaining what bandwidth is. Right, it's a quality aspect, not just quantity. All right, very good. Yeah. So, well, think about that and see how much more is there of this.
Oh, very little.
Right. Yeah. So we'll see if he wraps it up for us to what you're saying, or what you're saying leads to what they'll push us a little further. But, yes, bandwidth is your super angelic media ecology or paramedia ecology, how you can handle this situation. What would you say to others? Or if you were in charge in the White House, what would you say to the publics, plural? Is that what you mean by fast? The quality of the depth of your communication, what you think you're talking to and how it's responding to you. Now, I say that's what I'm doing twice a week with Ion. It's really tricky interacting with Ion now that the tech body's intermixed too. So we might be coming up to an explanation of what I've been going through in the last few weeks on the show in this final part of the dialogue. But very good. You're a good man to figure this out with there.
Well, I'm mostly a listener, which I don't.
No, you're not. You're doing a lot of talking.
I learn stuff, and I appreciate it.
Right, but you're doing a lot of talking, or you're faking your talking, and you're actually listening. Okay, very good.
Good.
Let's see if we got all of this on tape. So, have a good day, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Yes,
okay.
Sir.
Bye, Cameron.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.